Going on anyway in chapter 37, it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Eternal. And he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, and Shebna the scribe and the elders of the priest, covered with sackcloth, unto Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. Well, they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy. For the children are come to the birth, and there's not strength to bring forth. Now, some of the authorities believe that Hezekiah wrote these songs of degrees, and they may well be right, because a lot of the psalms back in, you might turn back and notice a few of these in Psalm 122. There are a lot of parallels with what he's saying here in this part of Isaiah. I was glad when they said unto me, let's go into the house of the Eternal. Our feet will stand within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem's built as a city that's compact together. Now, some of these may have been written by Hezekiah, and some of them may have been written by David. Verse 9, because of the house of the Eternal, our God, I'll seek your good. Then Psalm 134, behold, bless you the Eternal, all servants of the Eternal, which by night stand in the house of the Eternal. Lift up your hands in the sanctuary and bless the Eternal. The Eternal that made heaven and earth, bless you out of Zion. Now, quite a few of the terms that are used here in Isaiah, we'll see a little later, are actually written once again in these songs of degrees. In Psalm 130, out of the depths I've cried unto you, O Eternal. So some think the dark day that he was writing about there was when he wrote this psalm. Out of the depths I've cried unto you, O Eternal. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. Now, whether some of these are directly references to this trouble going on at that time or not, there are quite a few parallels in some of these songs of degrees. In fact, some people think that he wrote some of these because of the episode of the sundial going back 10 degrees, and that he had 15 years added to his life, so he put these 15 psalms together. Of course, they had the 15 steps in the temple, and they'd sing one of these on each of the steps in kind of a ceremony or a ritual at the feast time. So there may be a lot of parallels there, and maybe we can have more time to check out the possibility later on. Come back to Isaiah once again. Some of the statements used here are almost identical back in Kings, where the same history is recounted back there. Verse 3, this day is the day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy, for the children are come to the birth and there's not strength to bring forth. So that's the kind of a predicament they were in, as if a mother was right there ready to deliver a baby, but it wouldn't be born. It may be the Eternal, your God, will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria, his master, has sent to reproach the living God. So maybe God will hear what he said and will reprove the words which the Eternal, your God, has heard. Wherefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that's left. So Sennacherib had devoured the northern families, and the Assyrians had taken Israel captive, but they said, lift up your prayer for the remnant, the few tribes that are left out of all of Israel. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, thus you'll say to your master, thus says the Eternal, don't be afraid of the words you heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I'll send a blast on him, and he'll hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I'll cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So God agitated trouble from another enemy, and he heard the rumors of it, as we'll read a little later, and turned and fled and left the area. So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libnah, because he'd heard that he was departed from Lachish. So he heard say concerning Terhakah, king of Ethiopia, he's come forth to make war with you. And when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, thus you'll speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, you've heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by destroying them utterly. Shall you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those which my fathers have destroyed? So here he goes back several generations to how the power that was there had conquered and devastated and transplanted peoples and ruled. The gods of the nations haven't delivered them, which my fathers have destroyed, as Gozan and Haran and Rezeph, the children of Eden that were in Telassar. Some of these are over along the Euphrates and Mesopotamia, and some of them on up in what's modern Syria and Iran. Where is the king of Hamath, and the king of Arphad, and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Enan and Iva? So Hezekiah received a letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up unto the house of the Eternal and spread it before the Eternal. And that's always an inspiration, you know, to think that when somebody sends you a threat or some kind of a warning, you can just take that and spread it out before God and say, well, God, you listen to what this school board says. I'm going to give all of our students F if they go to the feast. And God, would you read this letter now? This guy says, if I go to the feast, I won't have a job when I come back. And you know, that's always kind of a simple way to do it. You just take it in and spread it out before God and say, well, now, God, look what these people are writing against you. Well, these are your days. This is your way. You drafted me into this, God. This is your battle. And that's really a smart thing to do, and that's why Hezekiah always succeeded. Because he always had that same habit. He'd go up to the house of the Eternal and spread it before the Eternal. Wasn't his problem, you know. They weren't his people. Wasn't his country. But a little later, you'll find out he got a little big-headed and began to think about the great work that he'd built and all the greatness of his work and everything. And, well, Hezekiah prayed unto the Eternal, saying, O Eternal of hosts, God of Israel, that dwells isn't really a good translation there, but reigns between the cherubim, that are the God. You are the God. You're the only God. You're He, the real God. You alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. All these other so-called gods, you've created all of them. Or if they've got gods that are rivers, or the sun, or the moon, or the stars, you created all them. And if they've got gods that are made out of stone and wood, you created all those trees and all those ingredients for cement. And you know, Mr. Armstrong always goes back to God being the creator. Paul did in Acts, and God's servants, Daniel did too. So that's a biblical trait of God's servants. They always go back to saying, well, wait a minute now. This is the creator God. This is a God by evidences above all the other gods, because he's made everything that people proclaim are gods. Incline your ear, O Eternal. You know, that's an unusual statement. It's kind of like, well, God, you're not listening very closely up there. Bend your head over and, you know, incline your ear. You know, if you're talking to someone and they're not really paying any attention to you, and you just say, Bill, turn your ear over here and listen. That used to frighten me when I'd read how men in the Bible prayed. And I remember the first time I got down on my knees with Mr. Armstrong and anointing somebody with a flu over in Big Sandy. You know, I was ready to get up and get out of there, because he was telling God what he had to do and what he promised he'd do, and he couldn't break his word, and he was bound to do this, and I never heard anybody pray like that in my life before. But look what Isaiah or Hezekiah says. Incline your ear, O Eternal, and hear. That's kind of frightening to think about doing that, saying that to God. Open your eyes, O Eternal, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which has sent to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Eternal, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries. And of a truth, they have cast their gods into the fire, but they weren't gods. Otherwise, you couldn't burn them in fire. They're just the work of men's hands. Wood, stone, that's why they've been able to destroy them. Now, therefore, O Eternal, our God, save us from his hand, that all the kings of the earth may know that you're the Eternal, you only, There's only one God. There's only one great God, true God, living God. Then Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent to Hezekiah, saying, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, whereas you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria." Now, you know, there are a lot of parallels in the statements and attitudes of this king of Assyria to the one that's going to be the beast power in the end time, too. And you think about some of the things this king of Assyria had to say to God's people. They may well try that again. You know, the false prophet might come along and the beast and try to tell God's people exactly what Rabshakeh and Sennacherib tried to tell them back in Hezekiah's day. Try to get us divided, try to get us to reason and not follow our leader, not believe what he says. So when you read Isaiah 36 and 37 and 38, you might read it over a few times. One time just read it as if it's talking about the beast and the false prophet in the end time. Then another time just read it as history. And then maybe another time read it as prophecy of that old day. But a lot of the things said here are typical of the false prophet and the beast in the end time. So Isaiah, anyway, sends to Hezekiah, "Thus says the eternal God of Israel, whereas..." Now you notice he still calls him the eternal God of Israel, though 10 tribes are already gone. And they admitted they were gone. They talked about Samaria not being able to deliver any of them. And when he talked about what's left, he talks about the remnant that's left. But you know, some modernists would have you believe that enough of those 10 tribes stayed behind and came down into the south, that all the 12 tribes continued in Palestine under the leadership of Judah. And that's not true. You don't find that in the Bible. But that's what some people would have you believe. Now, of course, other people would have you believe, since the Assyrians took the Israelites captive, and later on Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians took the Jews captive, they were in captive in such close proximity that they ended up amalgamating together and ended up being the 12 tribes. And then when the Jews came back out of Babylon, then that was all the 12 tribes. And that isn't true either. Because it doesn't say that in Daniel, you know. It talks about Israel that's far off.
Of course, that's God's interventions in history. So God brought on Cyrus and caused all his victories and gave him instructions as to how to deal with Palestine. He pursued them, passed safely by the way he had gone with his feet. Who has wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning? I am the eternal, the first, and with the last. I am he. The isle saw it and feared, and the ends of the earth were afraid, and they drew near and came. They helped everyone his neighbor, and everyone said to his brother, "Be of good courage." So here were adjoining countries counseling one another about the way they should deal with Cyrus. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smooth with a hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, "It's ready for the soldering," and he fastened it with nails that it shouldn't be moved. "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend." That's unique terminology, you know. Not too many people in the Bible you find that. David was a man after God's own heart, but was he God's friend? "Abraham, my friend, whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called you from the chief men thereof." So you notice, according to God's terminology there, the descendants of Abraham are the chief men of the earth from all down through history. "And said to you, 'You're my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you away. So don't you fear. I'm with you. Don't be dismayed. I'm your God. I'll strengthen you. Yea, I'll help you. Yea, I'll uphold you.'" So he's kind of giving you the message here that he tells you in chapter 40, that you should comfort my people, speak comfortably to them, and now he's telling you what to think, and he's giving you his own words of comfort. "Behold, all they that were incensed against you," all those European beast power nations, "they're going to be ashamed and confounded. They're going to be as nothing. They that strive with you are going to perish. You're going to seek them, and you'll not find them. Then that contended with you, they that war against you are going to be as nothing and as a thing of naught." So Edom and Babylon are going to be burning desolations the first part of the millennium. "I, the eternal, your God, I'm going to hold your right hand and say to you, don't be afraid, I'll help you. Don't be afraid, you worm Jacob. You really are just a grub. Same word as grub, grubworm. You go from fly to worm and back to fly to worm again, you men of Israel. I'll help you, says the Eternal. Incidentally, it says, you few men of Israel, you remnant, you small number that's left, I'll help you, says the Eternal, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I'll make you a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. So God's going to use Israel in the beginning of the millennium to bring nations into subjection and under authority and into God's way. You'll thresh these nations about you, and in Europe, they're going to be dealt with, beat them small and make the hills as chaff. You'll fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them, and you'll rejoice in the Eternal, and you'll glory in the Holy One of Israel. When the poor and needy seek water, and there's none, their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them, and will send rains and open underground rivers. And I, the God of Israel, I won't forsake them. I'm going to open rivers in high places. I'm going to cause fountains to burst out of the midst of the valleys. I'm going to make the wilderness a pool of water. The dry land is going to be springs of water. I'm going to plant in the wilderness the cedar, all these different trees, myrtle, olive. I'll set in the desert fir tree, pine, box together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together the hand of the Eternal has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. Now, how do you think God's going to set those trees there? Just wave his magic wand and say, zap, 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 you know, and just going to have all these trees all of a sudden pop up out of the ground? No, I don't believe that. I believe we're going to go out there and teach these people how to plant the trees and things that we're going to have to be taught ourselves. But I don't think God's going to wave a magic wand and you're going to have a utopian, beautiful world just instantaneously in a few years. Well, you know, I'd be happy if he did it that way to save a lot of work. But people don't learn a whole lot that way. Produce your cause, says the Eternal. Bring forth your strong reason, says the King of Jacob. That's a great title for God, isn't it? The King of Jacob. That has to be Christ. Let them bring them forth and show us what shall happen. Let them show the former things what they be, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them and declare us things for to come. In other words, are there any other books or beings that are able to prophesy and it happen? I mean, great major events. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that you're God. So in God's own words, that's one way of knowing God is God. Look what all he foretold, major events in world history that happened. And nobody else has ever been able to do that. No other religious books, no other religious leaders. Only the Bible, only God's prophets have been able to show us what God is foretelling and making happen. Do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and behold it together. That's another way you can know God. When he says something's good and you try it out, it is. And when he says something's bad and you learn the hard way, it is. So that's another way you can depend on God. Behold, you're of nothing, your work of naught, an abomination is he that chooses you. Any of these other things that claim to be God, any of the other religions or God, they're of nothing. Their work is naught. An abomination is he that chooses you. Well, I've raised up one from the north, and he's going to come from the rising of the sun. He'll call upon my name. He'll come upon princes as upon mortar and as the potter treads clay. Who has declared from the beginning that we may know, and before time that we may say, he's righteous. Yea, there's none that shows, yea, there's none that declares. Nobody's been able to do what God's been able to do, to foretell all these major events and they happen. Yea, there's none that hears your word. The first shall say to Zion, behold, behold them, and I'll give to Jerusalem one that brings good tidings. For I beheld, and there was no man even among them, there was no counselor, that when I asked of them could answer a word. No, none of these gods or religions, not even among the humans of Zion and the leaders. God beheld and asked any man, and none of them had any counsel or any answers. Behold, they're all vanity. Their works are nothing. Their molten images are wind and confusion. But in some of the chapters coming up, there are some terms, like in chapter 45, he talks about the anointed and subduing nations before him, and it's the same phraseology as here. And there it's for sure talking about Cyrus. But in a dual sense, it could be referring to Christ. The righteous from the east called him, gave the nations before him, made him rule over kings. We should get into chapter 45 next time, so we'll parallel that with this chapter 41 and look at them together. Chapter 41, I might make one comment. There seems to be a variance depending on what source you read as far as who the righteous man from the east in verse 2 was. Most of the Jewish element seems to think that it's referring to Abraham, and others seem to think it's referring to Cyrus. Some mention because it talks about the righteous from the east, that it's more than likely talking about Abraham here. And yet, the people that think it's talking about Cyrus say the righteousness doesn't have to do with the individual, but it has to do with God using him as an instrument to bring right, bring justice or equity, or to bring to pass God's plan or God's purpose. In the Sanfino, they make a comment here about this particular verse. He raised up the righteous from the east, visually Cyrus. The Targum and Jewish commentators understand it as a patriarch Abraham, but this is less appropriate to the text. And when they talk about righteous, they mention that here it's with a sense of vindication of the right, that Cyrus was used to vindicate the right, and his conquest may indeed have already begun at this time. So we'll try to nail it down any further than that. Maybe you can learn more by considering it both ways and just putting it in your mind that it can either be talking about Cyrus or Abraham, and of course primarily it's talking about Christ in the future, ultimately. What you get into in the 40 chapters of Isaiah is God continually is talking about a servant that he raises up. In some cases he's talking about Cyrus. In some cases he's talking about Christ in the future. In some cases he's talking about Israel. Of course, if you read in Jewish commentaries or Jewish ideas, they're going to eliminate the idea that it could be a prophecy about the Messiah. As a matter of fact, back in Daniel, where most of us have always understood the key prophecy about the Messiah being born at a time and cut off in the middle of the week and causing sacrifice and oblation to cease, it's kind of interesting sometime to read that in a Jewish commentary, or read it in Sanfino, or somewhere where they don't want any of these references to be about a Messiah, other than one that's coming as an intervening king to restore the empire back to Israel. So where it talks about a redeemer, they'll always make it refer to physical redemption from a battle or a war. And when it talks about a savior, they never use it spiritually. They always use it as referring to being saved from an enemy or being saved from a captivity. In Daniel chapter 9, we understand the 70 weeks prophecy that are determined on the people of Israel, on the holy city. So that shows who it refers to, it's upon them, and then he begins to tell what all is going to be involved in those 70 weeks. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, how anybody could read that and not realize that's talking about the Messiah. It's talking about Christ coming, living, being crucified, coming back again. Quite often when the Bible, the way the Bible writes, it'll give you a summary first. like Genesis 1, the summary of creation. Then it backtracks and fills in some of the details. And that's what he does here. First of all, he tells you about 70 weeks. And then he says, now let's break that down a little further. And that's what he does here. But according to the Tonsino and the Jewish ideas, you have two different princes referred to here. They think one might even refer to Herod. And they've come up with time periods that have 3.5 years. They've come up with time periods that have 69 weeks and 7 weeks. So they make all of this physical to get around any prophecies about a Messiah, about Christ coming and being born and crucified and fulfilling the 70 weeks prophecy. And then in verse 25 he says, know therefore and understand from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince. Of course, when we read that, it's very plain and common and very easily understood, because it's talking about from the time the decree to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple and everything, the streets and all, unto the Messiah the Prince would be 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. Then he adds as a after comment, the street shall be built again after those weeks, and the wall. So the street and the wall would come after that time and would be in troublous times. Now he comes back again and backtracks again and says, now, after those 62 weeks. But you know, if you were to write this down, first you'd have 70 weeks, then you'd have a summary comment about what's going to happen during that time period of 70 weeks. Then you break it down and you have 7 plus 62. And what's mentioned in verse 25. And then again, you have something else after those 62, which are, of course, after the 7. That's when the Messiah would be cut off, but not for himself. Then the people of the prince that would come would destroy the city and the sanctuary. Then he, in verse 27, comes back up to Messiah in verse 26. The only antecedent he could come back to. Certainly doesn't talk about they or an army he. But he, the Messiah, confirms the covenant with many for 1 week. So you've had 7 weeks plus 62. That's only 69. So you still have that one last week yet to count. And that's what he does in verse 27. He confirms the covenant with many for 1 week. The only trouble is he didn't get that job finished before he got cut off in the midst of that week. So Christ died in the midst of that last 70th week. And he's got the last half of that 70th week to complete yet. And what'll he do when he comes back? Well, he'll confirm the covenant with many for the remainder of that 70th week. Now, you know, when you read that, it very exactly fits into the prophecies about Christ, and yet when the Jews read it, they're not going to let that apply to Christ, because it tells you he'd die on a Wednesday, it told you he'd do away with the ritual law, it told you so much detail about what he would do. So they apply that to Cyrus, or they apply it to Herod, or they apply it to various human leaders. Now, that's what you're going to run into when you're reading here in Isaiah 40, 41, 42, on through 45. So we might keep that in mind as we go on here then. Isaiah 42, behold, my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. Now, of course, when we read that, the Protestant scholars in 1611 that made this King James translation, they put in the margin a little T with a circle around it, which shows they believe that's talking about the Messiah, the prophecy about the Messiah, all the first four verses. And then again down in verse 6 and 7. And that's what that means in your Bible if you have those particular markings. And here's what Tonsino says in this case even. Behold my servant, Israel. And yet he says the Septuagint has the reading, Jacob is my servant, I'll help him, Israel is my chosen, my soul has accepted him. But according to others, the allusion is to Cyrus, as quoted by Ibn Ezra. The Jewish commentators are divided. Some say it refers to Israel. Some say it refers to the king Messiah. And others say Isaiah was talking about himself. So that's how you get around Old Testament prophecies referring to the Messiah. You just apply them to everybody imaginable, except the one it refers to. Now you might remember, back in Matthew chapter 12, we might turn and notice this. Of course, if you were a Jew, you wouldn't turn to the New Testament, so you couldn't do this. Matthew 12, the Pharisees went out, held a council against him, how they might destroy him. Jesus, perceiving this, withdrew himself. Great multitudes followed him. He healed them all. Charged them that they shouldn't make him known, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah, the prophet, saying, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the street. A bruised reed he'll not break, smoking flax he'll not quench, till he send forth judgment and the victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust." So if you believe in the New Testament, that wipes out these other arguments about who this might refer to, because there it applies it very plainly to Christ. We have an important phone call for John Vieira. If you'd please go out to the lobby. I think it's Vieira. Is it Vieira? It's like ours. Okay, going ahead. "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my elect, in whom my soul delights." So here again, notice how the Hebrew word nephesh is used. Your soul can delight in a servant. Then he says, "I have put my spirit upon him." Of course, this is one of the good Trinity verses, because they say, here's the Father talking. He talks about his servant, and he talks about his spirit. So even the Companion Bible says, here's the doctrine of the Trinity. The Father, the Speaker, my servant, the Messiah, the Son, and my Spirit. So once again, one of the many non-Trinity scriptures that they use to try to get it in the Bible somewhere. "He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street." Of course, we understand that means not our job to go down here like the man outside of Beatles with his gravel voice that reads out scripture all day long. You know, it's not our job to get out and ring bells like Salvation Army people do. And it's not our job to have rescue missions and cause God's voice to be heard in the street. Try to get everybody saved, or try to get everybody to believe in the Messiah or to believe in Christ. "He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break." So he didn't come that first time to judge, to break weak individuals, or to quench smoking individuals who are about ready to be destroyed or burnt. "A bruised reed he'll not break, and the smoking flax he'll not quench." You might want to write hell across that verse, because notice even flax not being quenched. I guess that means it burns forever. If something not being quenched means it burns forever, then smoking flax burns forever. Of course, it doesn't. The smoking flax he wouldn't quench, showing that it can be quenched, and yet the Protestants use the term not quenched as if it means it burns forever and lasts forever. "He'll bring forth judgment to truth. He'll not fail, nor be discouraged, till he have set judgment in the earth, and the isles," in this case, most of the term isles are referring to the distant lands or regions of the earth. It doesn't mean literally a body of land surrounded by water necessarily. can mean coastland. It can mean extreme. In other words, the extremes of countries, the edges of the water. The coastlands of Russia or China or Japan or whatever. They're going to wait for God's law. And there again showing a millennial setting when God's law is going to be the power that's going to be governing the earth. Thus says God, the Eternal. In this case, you have the word El, the Hebrew word. And you literally have here, thus saith the God, the Eternal. The El, the Eternal. Which is an unusual terminology. You usually have just the Eternal God. But he's emphasizing the fact here that this is the only God. This is the real, true God, the living God. All these other idols, all these other nations' gods aren't really gods. Thus says the God, the El, the Eternal. He that created the heavens and stretched them out. He that spread forth the earth and that which comes out of it. He that gives breath unto the people upon it, and spirit to them that walk therein. Now, of course, here's an example of how he must be talking about the spirit in man, because he talks about two separate breaths. He talks about the breath first, neshama, the Hebrew word. Then after that, he talks about the spirit. And he uses two separate words. The one is talking about the breath of life, the essence of life in individuals, and the other must be talking about the spirit in man. I, the Eternal, have called you in righteousness, and that sometimes is misunderstood. It doesn't mean we were righteous and therefore he called us. It means because God is righteous, he has the time period when he calls everybody. I've called you to righteousness, or in my righteousness, I've called you. But it doesn't mean the individuals being called are righteous. And will hold your hand. That might sound a little bit Protestant-y or a little bit sentimental, but, you know, when someone is elderly or someone is stumbling along in the dark, and someone just gives them a balancing hold of the hand, it doesn't mean God just is your sidekick forever, every day, you know, and he provides parking spots for you and is a hip-pocket God, you know. Some people have that attitude toward God. Well, that's not what he's saying here. I'll keep you and give you British. You never imagined British would be in the Bible, would you? Well, British is in the Bible twice. That's one of the places. Covenant people is what it really says there. Even Sansino mentions the phrase may signify, quote, a covenant people related to God by a covenant. Two words, Kish, people, and Bereth, covenant. And the same thing is mentioned once again in the scriptures, this time in, again in Isaiah, Isaiah 49, and verse 8. Thus says the Eternal, in an acceptable time I've answered you. In a day of salvation I have helped you. I'll preserve you and give you British, the covenant people. So imagine the very scripture that's misquoted all the time by the Protestants in the New Testament. Now is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. They misquote that verse. And yet, that very verse goes on to say, I'll preserve you and give you British, covenant people. So God is going to cause the covenant people, Israel, to raise up the land and to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. When God says to the prisoners, come out of your captivity. Well, that's kind of interesting to realize God had that right in the scriptures. And Mr. Armstrong talks about covenant people, the two words combined, and it's actually here in the scriptures. Going on in verse 6, I, the Eternal, have called you in righteousness, will hold your hand, will keep you, give you for a covenant people, for a light of the Gentiles, So in the millennium, Israel is going to shine as the light to the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison. And you may want to jot down Isaiah 35:5. That takes you back where we were earlier when God had repeated the same thing. The eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, the lame will leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb will sing. So he's taking you back again in context to the story flow back in Isaiah 35. But now God is going to make this covenant people, this light of the Gentiles, open the blind eyes and bring out the prisoners from the prison. And them that sit in darkness, they're spiritually blinded. Them that sit in darkness, out of the prison house. And here you might look ahead a little bit in Isaiah 49 and verse 9, where we're reading about the covenant people in verse 8, verse 9, that you may say to the prisoners, go forth. To them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They'll feed in the ways, their pasture shall be in all high places. They'll not hunger or thirst. The heat of the sun won't smite them. So here again, the repeating of that very miracle of enlightenment in the future, again in Isaiah 61, another prophecy chapter about Israel being sons of God, being saviors, deliverers. Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord Eternal is upon me, because the Eternal has anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captive, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Eternal. Now, some people think that means that soon after Christ comes back and finishes instructing Israel is regathered, then you're going to have a Jubilee year. And that's what he's talking about in verse 2, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Eternal. But it's very obvious here he's talking about not just the prophecy about Christ when God's Spirit was on him, when he had been anointed to preach good tidings. But this is more totally fulfilled when you tie it in with these other scriptures in Isaiah 42 and 49 with the sons of God, the Spirit, born again church, the Israelites, who are going to go out and not just the Christ when he was here, but even beyond that to the people of Israel, as it does here in chapter 42. The covenant people are going to be for a light of the Gentiles. The covenant people are going to open the blind eyes. They're going to bring out the prisoners from the prison. And those that sit in darkness are going to be brought out of the prison house by the covenant people, not just by Christ. Of course, he's the forerunner and the beginner of the faith. So it always applied to him first of all. But now back to Isaiah 42 in verse 8. I am the Eternal, that is my name, and my glory I'll not give to another. You remember back in the Ten Commandments, he said, the Lord your God is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children. He said, you'll have no other God before me. So he doesn't share his worship with any other God. I'm the Eternal, that's my name. And my glory I'm not going to give to another, neither my praise to graven images. So quite often as a jealous God, you're going to find a great deal of emphasis on God saying, me. And you'll notice that as you go through these next couple of chapters. And it all starts with this verse 8. I'm the Eternal, and that's my name, and I'm the one that's the real true God. My glory, I'm not going to let anybody else share my position as your God. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Now, you know, that verse by itself shows there aren't two Isaiahs. And you never read in the New Testament where any part of Isaiah is quoted, and the man would say, according to first Isaiah, or according to second Isaiah. You know, it's just the ignorance of man to try to make two Isaiahs just because the first half of the book seems to be bad news more, and the last half seems to be good news more. But notice what this verse says. The former things back in the first 40 chapters are come to pass, and new things in the next chapters I do declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. So when Mr. Armstrong says prophecy is one of the proofs of God, he's speaking by authority of the Scripture. Because all the way through here, God is showing that other gods haven't been able to foretell prophecy. You know, you ever read the prophecy books out of the Quran? Or you ever read the prophecy books of the Hindus? Or any prophecy books out of any other religion? No, only in the Bible. So the things about Sennacherib, the things about Israel's captivity, the things about Egypt and their fall, all of those former things Isaiah foretold, some of them had already happened by this time, and now he's going to declare new things that haven't yet happened. So we can know he really is God. Then in verse 10, he says, sing unto the Eternal a new song. In so many places, when you run across that in the Bible, it's literally talking about a victory song. His praise from the end of the earth. You that go down to the sea, and all that is therein, the coastlands of the nations, and the inhabitants thereof. See, that's what he means from the end of the earth. Lands that spread out to the ends of the earth till they meet the sea. All the way to your coastlands, all the way to where your country drops off into the ocean. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice. The villages that Keter does inhabit. Let the inhabitants of the rock, maybe Petra. I think even Sansino says that may be a reference to Petra. Well, I wonder who the inhabitants of Petra are. When is this song sung? When is this praise sung? Notice it's a worldwide praise from the end of the earth. Well, wouldn't it be something if we read a little later about Israel being scattered to the north and the south and the east and the west, all the way to the ends of the earth, all the way to the coastlands of the nations, and they're going to be brought back from all those areas, and then they sing this victory song. And that's really what you're going to read. Because he's not talking about Jews coming back out of Babylon, and he's not talking about Israel, that nowhere was ever said that they'd come back for centuries until the millennium. Who are these he's referring to that go down to the sea and all therein, all these coastlands, the wilderness, cities that lift themselves up in the wilderness, in the areas of Keter, the inhabitants of the rock, singing, shouting from the top of the mountain, showing they've been scattered into all the various countries, the various big major countries. Let them give glory unto the Eternal and declare his praise. Here you notice these people are coming back to God, and they're remembering God in the places they're scattered, and they're giving glory to the Eternal, and they're declaring his praise to these coastlands of the nations where they've been scattered. The Eternal shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He'll prevail against his enemies. So here you see God intervening. Matter of fact, it's actually the time back in Revelation when there's rejoicing and thanksgiving and praise because God no longer delays. He no longer is sitting back, letting man go his way and letting Israel remain in the captivity. All of a sudden, God is going to wake up and rend the heavens and come down. Notice verse 14. I have long time holding my peace. I've been still and refrained myself. The time has come. God has given me the word that time should be no more, so I'm going to rend the heavens and come down. Like the seventh trumpet back in Revelation 11. I'll cry like a travailing woman. Another picture of the time when Christ intervenes to come back. I'll destroy and devour at once. Well, that's how quickly it's going to happen once the time comes. But until that time comes, Israel's in a captivity, And God is biding his time, long time holding his peace, being still, refraining himself, showing he'd like to have intervened a lot sooner. He'd like to have not had to wait that long, but he refrained himself. And all of a sudden, he's going to cry. He's going to go forth with a shout, we know the seventh trumpet shows, as a mighty man stirring up because he's jealous of the way his people are treated by other peoples on this earth. Like a man of war, he's stirred up. He cries and roars as he goes out to regather Israel from their captivity, prevailing against these enemies that are having them captives into the four corners of the earth. I'll make waste mountains and hills. So that's what Christ is going to do when he comes back, with supernatural intervention, the super countries and the smaller countries. He's going to make them waste and dry up all their herbs, make the rivers islands, and dry up the pools. So apparently before he comes back, weather calamities are going to accompany his return. Then I'll bring the blind by a way that they knew not. I'll lead them in paths that they have not known. I'll make darkness light before them and crooked things straight. These things I'll do to them and not forsake them. And you'll see here he's talking about Israel's blindness. They don't know who they are. They don't know what's happened to them and why, and they've been blind. He's not talking about the physical blind earlier that he talked about Israel healing and opening eyes in the millennium. But here he's talking about his people who've gone into all these scattered countries in a captivity and bringing them as blind by a way they haven't known, leading them in paths they haven't known. They haven't known God's paths. They've never lived God's way. Then their darkness will be made light. They'll see the truth. They'll be understanding and enlightened and called. And the crooked things that so-called Christianity is made out of God's religion will be made straight. These things I'll do to them and not forsake them. They shall be turned back. They shall be greatly ashamed. They'll realize they've been trusting in idols, paganism, heathenism. They'll be ashamed then because they've said, "You're our gods," to graven images and to molten images. "Hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. Who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger that I sent?" So here he's showing he's talking about Israel, God's servant, not the servant from back up in verse 1, but this case talking about the servant, Israel, that he would be sending out, and they've been deaf and they've been blind, but they're going to be chained so they can see. Who is blind as he that's perfect, and blind as the eternal servant? So here they're supposed to have been God's messengers to the world to show the world God's way, and yet they haven't. You'll find what he says a little later. "Seeing many things, but you observe not. Opening the ears, but he hears not." And that's one description that's common all the way through the major prophets. When God talks about blindness and deafness, he repeats that again and again, as we'll see a little later in, I think, chapter 43. You find that in Jeremiah, you find that in Ezekiel, you find that in some of the minor prophets, and of course it's right in the beginning of the New Testament. Verse 21, "The Eternal is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will magnify the law and make it honorable." Now, is that really a prophecy about what Christ would do when he came? Well, what's he going to do when he takes away the blindness of Israel? What's he going to do when he takes away the deafness of Israel? When he removes their graven images and their molten images? Well, we're going to find out the law is going to go out of Zion, and it's going to be the new covenant he's going to make with Israel and Judah. And in that new covenant, the law is magnified. And that's how their blindness is removed. They see the law isn't done away with. They see you can keep the law. We had the men in the homiletics class today take a Pentecostal book with them against the Sabbath and go through in a Bible study format and refute it.
in this Pentecostal, like a Church of Christ preacher, my dad sicked on me back when I came out to Ambassador College to get me straightened out from this Armstrongism. Said, you can't keep the Sabbath. You can't keep that law. And I said, well, when you got a week to spare, come on over and find out. And if you want to find out once and for good whether you can keep the law, I invite you to come, follow me around for a week and see if I can keep the law. Well, they all have the idea that you can't keep the law, that they didn't keep the law, and it's all done away with. And yet, even in this prophecy about the millennium, when Christ intervenes as a warrior and brings Israel back out of their captivity, and the deaf hear and the blind see, look what it means. The law is magnified and made honorable, made where you can keep it, made where you can keep it in the Spirit, in its fullness. Now, the first part of verse 21, how do you become righteous? And the Eternal is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. So God isn't disappointed that righteousness is by his law. He's well pleased for his righteousness' sake. Because he's going to bring Israel into the fullness of his righteousness by magnifying the law and making it honorable in their understanding when they're enlightened and see. Back up in verse 19, who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger, who is blind as he that is perfect. It's kind of interesting. This is a Hebrew word from whence you get the word Muslim. Because the Hebrew word is mashalom. Mashalom. The same place we get an English word similar to that, but it's where they get the word Muslim. It just means perfect. So even that word's in the Bible, but not in the sense of the Muslim religion. Now, verse 22. He comes back to describing Israel once again. But this is a people robbed and spoiled. They're all of them snared in holes. They're hid in prison houses. They're for a prey and none delivers. So even at the time of Israel's captivity, when Israel's regathered at Christ's return, in a sense of duality, they're in prison even there. But the real prison they're let loose from is their blindness and their unconverted deafness to God. And yet they're literally blinded as well. They're literally captives. They're literally prisoners. So that's how he describes Israel in verses 22 and 23 and 24 and 25 at the time of their captivity. This is a people robbed and spoiled, all snared in holes, hid in prison houses, into the four corners of the earth. They're for a prey and none delivered. So you notice how the prophet goes backward and forward, captivity and deliverance, captivity and deliverance. And that's why you have to have God's Spirit and you have to have the church, the mother, to guide you in understanding the way the Bible's written. It surely is. Here a little, there a little, line on line, precept on precept, back and forth, you know, and back and forth. So now he comes back to Israel in their sad captive state. They're for a prey, none delivers. They're for a spoil, none says restore. Who among you will give ear to this? Who will hearken and hear for the time to come? Who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? Didn't the Eternal? Well, he had to, or they wouldn't have been spoiled and robbed. He against whom we have sinned, for they would not walk in his ways. And there you notice in a way they're blaming their ancestors. They say, that's right, we have sinned, and yet they wouldn't. You know, our ancestors didn't either, though. Well, that doesn't make any difference. But notice the change of pronouns. Whom we have sinned, for they would not walk in his ways, neither were they obedient unto his law. Therefore, the Eternal has poured upon Israel the fury of his anger and the violence of battle, the strength or violence of battle. It has set him on fire round about, yet he didn't know it. It burned him, yet he didn't lay it to heart. So as Israel is going through their difficulties, when God is no longer with us, and when we're getting poured on us the strength of Vietnam or the strength of other wars that we're not winning and haven't won, we've been set on fire round about, yet we don't admit it. We've been burnt here and there, and yet we're not going to lay it to heart. It isn't going to sink deeply in. We're not going to get scared about it. We're floating along on an economy that's going to come smashing down one of these days, that we've got a false security.